Well, hello and welcome to the unofficial Unreal Engine podcast, where we talk about all things Unreal Engine and also flyovers of fictional towns. I'm your host, Alex, and joined by me today is a very special guest. We have Tom Wexler in the house. Yay, Tom. Hooray. So exciting. Say hi to the crowd there, Tom.
Thank you very much for having me on your podcast.
Very excited to have you here. Quick background. It's been a little while since we've had an episode. I just returned from a wonderful trip to the UK. I was ostensibly there for the grant that we've had with the Royal Shakespeare Company doing a cool virtual reality rehearsal room set up for them. And then we figured as long as we're up at Stratford-upon-Avon, why not some time in London? And then some folks were also like, come down and develop Brighton. So then I was in Brighton for a day, but had an absolutely glorious time in London, bouncing around some different studios, including Journey / 59 Studios / Squint Opera, as well as seeing some incredible shows, including Stranger Things for Shadow, which we are going to talk about in depth today. But to keep everything in the way that we usually do things, we're going to start out with a little game of word association before we get to know Tom too much more than that. How's that sound, Tom?
Sounds good to me.
Great. Okay, so I'm going to say a word. You say whatever comes to mind. No wrong answers, but someday we're going to throw all this into an AI and get some very interesting responses from all the guests. Here we go. Home.
Oh, my goodness. Too many words. Okay, I'm not playing this game well, am I?
And by the way, it doesn't have to be one word. Like, you can say a sentence, a paragraph, whatever. Yeah, it's fine. No wrong answers.
Yeah, I'll go with family for home.
Right. Work.
Pressure.
Food.
Spice.
Travel.
Adventure.
Fortnight.
2 weeks.
You're the first person to give that answer, and I've wanted someone to give that answer for so long. Thank you. Unreal Engine.
Speed.
How do you take your coffee? These are slightly longer answers now. We're building up to longer form answers.
I can give you one word answer for that. It's espresso.
Espresso. Great. Fantastic. What is a book / movie / video game / immersive theater experience, some kind of media that really rocked your world?
Oh, that's a tough question. I'm going to say I've recently rewatched a lot of films about David Bowie for various reasons. And I've got to say it is The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Great choice. Yeah. Tom, what's your favorite time of day?
Evening.
And when was the last time you remember laughing in a meaningful way?
last night.
Yeah. Amazing. Ed, you want to give any context or just like, no, I laughed last night. It was a good time.
Just being stupid with my family. That's usually what happens of an evening in my house. There's usually quite a lot of laughter.
Love that. Cool. All right. You passed with flying colors. Before we go over into a little bit more of a deep dive interview with Tom here, just a little bit of Unreal Engine news. Last time I was talking to you all was after Unreal Fest Orlando, which of course was fantastic. Since then, I have been accepted to give a talk, maybe two talks, at Unreal Fest Stockholm. So I hope to see some folks over there. Victor Broden, of course, who runs XR at Epic Games, he is a Stockholm native, and he, I'm sure, is going to be giving us all a wonderful tour of the city. So I am looking forward to that, and I hope you are too. Besides that, you know, Unreal Engine 5.6 officially out, lots of cool new features. At some point, we will do a deeper dive into the ones that are our favorites so far. I will say that in our experience at Agile Lens, it has been a more stable release than I think what we had in 5.5 generally. Fewer crashes, fewer weird bugs and things like that. And we're excited for Meta to release their branch of the engine that hopefully will allow us to use application space warp and all this fun stuff that improves our frame rate for VR. Okay, I think that's it for news, really. So, Tom, I'm excited to dive in. So, quick background. So I've known various members of Tom's. Actually, let's start really quickly with the relationship between 59 Studio, Squint Opera, Journey, all these kinds of companies that are related to each other and working together in different capacities. Can you introduce us to that, Tom?
Sure, yeah. So I'm part of 59 Studio. We've been working as a studio for about 20 years, and we have often collaborate with lots of other partners working in kind of adjacent realms to ourselves. And in the last couple of years, we've got closer and closer to some of the other studios who are part of this group Journey, which is an umbrella group which has a lot of incredible studios within its structure. And about a year and a half ago, 59 officially became part of Journey. So we are now a Journey studio, which is incredibly exciting for us. It's like an opportunity to have a much more kind of close relationship with some of these people we've admired from a distance for a while. So yeah, it's a really exciting new chapter in the story of 59.
That's really cool. Yeah, what are some of the things you've noticed? Like, is there just more access to other talented individuals, more software, more hardware? What's been different?
Well, we're sort of in the process of getting closer to the other studios. We're still operating pretty much as an independent studio, but we have, as you say, we've had this opportunity to work with so many new talented individuals working with different technology and sometimes with the same technology, like expanding our skill set as a group and really being able to kind of reach across to other experts in adjacent fields and learn from them, which has been, I suppose it's been scary at times. It's been kind of, being part of a big group comes with lots of challenges as well. But the benefits of working with this amazing group that includes technologists who are doing wild stuff that we haven't been able to do before, and creatives who are coming up with ideas, and also new clients coming to the studio that we would we'd never have met before. So yeah, it's a lot of opportunities, and it's also given us a kind of way forward for the future to imagine how we might be able to bring those studios closer together and make output that really combines all the talents of those studios and kind of offers something that is a lot more integrated than we were able to before.
I love that. And do you want to give a little bit of a summary of each of the companies, I guess, starting with 59 Studio and what each of them kind of focuses and specializes in?
Yeah, sure. So 59 Studio, we started, as I say, about 20 years ago, really mostly working in theater. We were, the founders of the company were there at the very early stages of video design being a tool, a creative tool in theater. And although some kind of video design had been around for some time, it had always been a bit of an add-on. And 59 came in and sort of put it into stage, sort of literally. The company grew from there, working in theater and expanding to opera. And then really began expanding again the skill set and the output that we were making into areas like projection mapping, big public performances. And I suppose one of the really kind of game-changing moments was when we were asked by Danny Boyle to come on board for the London 2012 opening ceremony, which was the largest crowd that we'd ever had a chance to work with before, and the highest pressure situation possibly as well. But that really kind of sort of catapulted us into new realms of public performance. And we've been sort of expanding our remit into our skill set into spatial design, architecture, placemaking, music, film, VR, lots of different areas. Essentially, we get good at something and then we decide to do something new.
Is it interesting?
Yeah. And I think that's sort of driven by the characters that are in the company. We're sort of, I suppose, constantly curious about what we can do that hasn't been done before. We find ways of taking even media that has maybe been around for a long time, but we look at it sideways, or we maybe clash two different worlds together, and you know what happens if you combine film and theater and live filmmaking, and what happens if you combine dance and projection mapping and all these things that produce a kind of a new language, I suppose. So that's where we've come from. We're also do a lot of exhibition work. We were asked to do the David Bowie Is exhibition by the V&A a number of years ago, and that was the first time we'd done anything of that scale, certainly an exhibition like that. So that was incredibly exciting and you know, ultimately very successful, and has led to more exhibition work. So I think that's a broad summary of what 59 okay. Studio does. It's pretty hard to put it into a concise sentence. And then also in the Journey company, we've got Squint Opera, who I know you've met and know, who do an incredible amount of exhibition work, an incredible amount of sort of digital physical crossover, which I suppose taking digital media and putting it into the real world, which is very close synergies with what we do. And then also there's VMI, who are part of the Journey Group, and their real specialism is visualization and creating digital models for all sorts of purposes, often to do with visualizing new projects or kind of creating, imagining future worlds. So incredibly exciting company to work with there. And yeah, that's the London side of things. And then, yeah, we're just in the process of learning more about everyone who's part of the group. So it's super exciting time to be part of Journey for sure.
Yeah, that's amazing. And shout out to Sylvia Rueda from BMI, who I think we're about to bring over to New York for a little virtual production architecture workshop sort of thing. But everyone who I've met from these companies is absolutely brilliant, including some folks who I originally met when they're working for other companies, and they have now also come under that Journey umbrella. Just shows it's a great gathering place for super talented folks. Tom, let's back up a little bit and talk a little more specifically about you, where you came from, what some of your early passions were, and how you came to, were you the founder of 59 Studio?
No. So I joined 59 Studio about 8 years ago.
Gotcha.
And I, before that, had a career, a pretty kind of eclectic career, working in music, in theater, in dance, but always with a sort of visual eye on things. So I used to make a lot of visuals for the music industry, for live events, awards shows, things like that. And then I had a studio with a long-term collaborator who worked with for like nearly 20 years. And we combined that kind of more commercial side of things, making output for bands and for theater companies and so on, with our own sort of artistic practice, creating live, real-time public art installations around the world. So a pretty kind of experimental and eclectic sort of background, I suppose. We moved into making feature films for a while and moved into the world of visual effects, kind of by accident, but enjoyed that a lot, learning that super steep learning curve of working out how to integrate with all the other departments in that way and work on these long form projects. Say about 8 years ago, I decided I wanted to get back into live performance particularly and kind of see the audience, see the whites of the audience's eyes in a way that I had missed when I was working in film. And that's when I approached 59, and the work they were doing at that stage was just so exciting that I thought this is a great opportunity and came on board.
So I'm very excited, Tom, to be able to nerd out with you a little bit about live entertainment, which isn't something we've covered a ton on this podcast. I can maybe briefly tell a little bit of my origin story for a lot of the work I'm doing now, which came from studying abroad in London in 2008 and experiencing such a wide plethora of so much incredible live entertainment on stage, everything from, you know, concerts at the Royal Festival Hall to incredible theater performances at the National Theater, dance performances, things over at the Donmar Warehouse and West End and off West End. And it just made me want to do whatever I could to bring that kind of experience to more people. What entrances you about things on stage, and what brings you to do things that have a live element to them instead of, you know, feature film or visual effects or things that are more like, you're done and then, you know, it's off on a printed thing and then that's it, it's over?
I think for me, you know, it's mostly the that element where something, a piece of artwork is not complete until someone views it or listens to it or is present at it. And, you know, that obviously it does apply in TV and cinema. It's just that you're not there. Mm-hmm. And there's that, I suppose for me, just being in a room, it's a social thing, I guess. It's like feeling that energy coming off a crowd, whether it's at a gig or in a theater or, you know, or it's an exhibition, you know, all these different elements where the physical presence of people in the space is felt. And, you know, that for me is the big draw. I suppose that's what, you know, draws me to London and to be around places as you describe, you know, all those amazing live performance spaces. I don't know, I feel maybe it's become even more apparent in the last few years when, you know, we've been able to gather again in a way that, you know, we were restricted for a while. It's only reinforced how fundamentally important it is being a human to share these experiences with people.
100%. What's maybe an early memory you have of either attending or being a part of designing a show that really resonated with you?
So when I was a teenager, I really wanted to be a musician. Mm. That was the most important thing in my life at that point. But I was looking for work experience when I was about 17. And, you know, work experience as a musician is hard to come by, but I managed to get a role working in the sound department of a theater in Edinburgh, which is where I grew up.
Oh, yeah.
And and the piece we were putting on that week was, you know, sort of English farce. It was very light. It was, you know, it wasn't any great piece of art, but that kind of focused, concentrated energy going into making a piece, which was, you know, we knew the clock was ticking on Friday, that it was going to open for the first time. That sort of combination of technical and aesthetic decision-making that you're doing all the time, even though I was in a really, really junior role in that, I found that incredibly exciting. And even when things went wrong, that didn't put me off at all. In a way, that sort of, that adrenaline rush when you're kind of anticipating that this could either be a huge success or an absolute disaster.
Yeah.
It's like there's a sort of roller coaster thrill to it. And I think at that point I thought, you know, this is probably something that I'm going to want to be part of later in life. I then went on and studied music. So I didn't go straight into live performance in that way. But it became apparent, I'd say, you know, a few years later that I was never going to cut it as a musician. But if I could get, you know, if I could be part of that, part of that whole team that was putting together thing on stage, then that was close enough for me.
Amazing. Do you, by any chance, did you get to see In Pursuit of Repetitive Beats over at the Barbican?
I haven't seen it yet. No, I haven't. In fact, I'm not even sure it's still on now, but I'm it's squarely aimed at people like me, I think, and of my generation. So gutted I haven't seen it yet. I don't know if I'll get a chance.
Amazing. Let's talk briefly about virtual reality. When did you start entering that world, and what kind of utility have you found with it?
So this will probably come apparent during the course of this conversation. I'm a bit of a skeptic when it comes to technology, and I've never really got that excited by VR as a concept. Mm-hmm. And I think that's partly because of the, that social thing that I found like a barrier, having a physical thing on your face that, you know, separated you from the other people you were with, I found, you know, slightly problematic. But I did start to use it as a tool. And this is this was through my work, really, at 59. And we do a lot of pre-visualization of projects so that we can, in a tiny amount of time we often get to in a physical venue to put a show together, we know that we're aiming for something that we've already had a flavor of in advance. So, you know, if we're working on a theater show and I'm doing a lot of video design for it, we use VR to kind of imagine what that might look like, not just from one position, but from all different places in the auditorium. So I use it as a tool and actually found it incredibly useful and frustrating in equal measure. And then during 59, I'd been making several VR pieces by this point, but I hadn't been involved in any of them. And then during lockdown, just leading into lockdown and then completed during lockdown, I got a chance to work on a really exciting VR project that was a collaboration with Intel Studios, which was a experimental project based over in LA, where they had this enormous sound stage that was rigged up as a huge volumetric capture space. And volumetric capture that I'd come across to that point was like someone stood in a 6 foot by 6 foot square and, you know, could stand on the spot and do stuff. This was this absolutely enormous geodesic dome. Hey, you got a picture up there. Great. Where you could make whole performances in that space and capture it all volumetrically with the most ridiculously ambitious system you could imagine. And I think, I forget the details now, it's a few years ago, but I think there was something like 80 8K cameras filming at 60 frames a second in this space. So just the data side of it and the technical side of it was enormous. But we worked with them to make a kind of pilot project, which was based on the book here, the graphic novel here by Richard McGuire, which recently was also made into a film starring Tom Hanks, but it's a complete separate project to that a few years beforehand. And that was the piece we made out of that was a full 6 degrees of freedom VR piece that let you kind of inhabit this room that is the centerpiece for the whole novel and the whole the whole experience. The concept of this show was or this book was that you don't move physically in space at all, but you move in time through millions of years from like prehistoric swamps through to the present day, and you witness kind of human drama in the space, and then you also travel into the future and see what becomes of that space. So this felt like a really interesting project to try VR as a medium for. And we have, you know, this incredible technical challenge of dealing with this volumetric capture space. But then we wanted to give it a kind of a heart and a narrative and a reason to keep watching, which I think was one of those things for me that separates the good VR experiences from the less exciting VR experiences. You know? So it was almost like a feature film making process with script and sound design and composition and set design and what have you. But the end result was a VR piece for a 6 degree of freedom headset. So that was my like baptism of fire. You know, I didn't start with an easy one.
Let's pause there for a second, Tom, because I actually experienced here, and I didn't know that this was your studio. I loved this piece so much. I think I made a YouTube video just being like, here's all the reasons this is like a masterclass in a really excellent VR piece, especially as, you know, an architecture nerd, someone who really enjoys the use of space in this kind of setting. I loved the premise of like, yes, exactly. You're here in one spot and you're watching it evolve over time. And the temporal nature of what you can do in VR. I mean, I'm trying to remember some of the things I was raving about it back when I originally saw it 5 years ago. But you want to have things happen in VR that are not going to work as well as in any other medium. And moving through time and experiencing, you know, these little hints of these different stories of people. And of course, you know, when you're way, way back from many, many years ago, nature and all that, and seeing all things happen around you is really fascinating. Also, I don't know if you knew, there was another piece. It might have been in Venice the very same year that had a similar premise. I thought here was more successful, but I'm curious if you remember what the name was of the other piece that also was playing with kind of a similar idea.
I can't recall it. I do know what you're talking about. I can't remember the detail of it, but that was a peculiar festival that year because, of course, it was entirely virtual. The Venice showcase for all this work, which would have been an incredible finale to the process of making this piece, became an experience that we had to, log into from our homes. But it was, I suppose, in some ways, a very fitting way of delivering the project. But again, missed the social side of things. That would have met you there had it been physical.
yeah, that's how it goes. It was fascinating though. Like I was struck by the desire, of course, to keep these festivals going. And a few of them had entirely VR versions. Like Cannes did a really cool partnership with the Museum of Other Realities, and they actually built out like a whole museum wing, and you'd go into these different rooms and you'd see a little bit of exhibit design for each piece before you would essentially hop into the executable file to experience each show. And they had 360 videos and full six-off things. And South by Southwest, of course, did an interesting thing with a more abstractified version of Austin, Texas. But the way that all these different festivals tried to still maintain some sense of like, we're here together and we can still experience things at the same time inside virtual reality or otherwise was really kind of fascinating. But before I interrupted you, you were going to, I think, maybe talk about what you did after here with VR.
I took a long rest from VR after that. We returned to it again as a pre-visualization tool primarily. But in the meantime, in the interim, from when I'd first used it for as a headset I could put on to visualize the scene that we were making in our video design software, it had become the technology had moved on to the point when actually you can do much more pre-visualization in that space. And we've been trying to work out ever since what's the best workflow? How can we make this the most useful tool? And one of the things that we're really playing with at the moment, and this is ongoing, is using it as a production tool for a space that we had in London called Lightroom. So Lightroom is it sort of broadly falls under the category of the immersive venue, by which I mean, a box full of projectors. But it's an extraordinarily high-spec version of this. And it's a pretty large space. It's a single space. It's like 18 meters wide by 24 and 11 meters high. So it's a cavernous space in King's Cross in central London. And it is a... Lightroom is a joint venture between 59 and London Theatre Company. It opened a few years ago with a show about a show with David Hockney. So it's a collaboration. And this space, we're continuing to make lots of shows for this space. We just opened one last week about dinosaurs. It was working with the Prehistoric Planet team on that. And we've done one with Tom Hanks about the moon, and we did a project with Anna Wintour about Vogue. So like it's got a pretty ambitious scale stuff, but now that venue's open and running, it's kind of tricky to spend a lot of time in there programming and experimenting. And really, it's very hard on screen to like get a sense of what it feels like to be in that space. You're working with a canvas that's 27,000 pixels wide. It's kind of pretty unwieldy, but over the years we've been working in that space, we've been refining our approach using VR to basically have virtual tech sessions in the room so that we can really do a lot of the work that we would normally do in the room in our comfort, our own air-conditioned studio. And we're not shutting the building down to the public while we're doing so. So that is a sort of focus of our use of VR at the moment. And one of the things that I'm really keen on is finding a way in which we can do that in a collaborative way. So to that idea that to date we've been setting things up. Yeah, you know, let's try this scene, let's try this moment from this show, and putting a VR headset on one at a time, and everyone go, oh yeah, that's good, I've got some notes on this or whatever. What I'd really like to do is find the equivalent VR setup so that we to being in the space. So a group of us all in VR headsets, all able not just to see it but also work in that space at the same time. So, you know, when we're in that space teching a show, we have a load of desks out, we've got sound designer, we've got video designers, we've got all sorts of different technical departments working on it. And that is one of the reasons why being in the physical space is so brilliant, because we bring that focus of us all together. If we can do that without having to be 40 feet underground in King's Cross and shutting the building down, then it opens up a whole new load of possibilities for the kind of the amount of work that we can do. So it's a challenge at the moment, and we're kind of got some very exciting kind of early experiments going. But, you know, I don't think it's ever going to be a place where we get to the end point. I think we're just going to constantly keep refining, keep tweaking. And, you know, it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I'll tell you briefly that the work we were doing with the Royal Shakespeare Company was similar to what you're describing. We had built mixed reality multiplayer setup so that we could be either in a rehearsal room with a large enough open space to simulate being in the Swan or any other theater, or you could actually be in the actual Swan and then start to add in all these other elements for, you know, set design elements or projections or anything else. And the goal, of course, was to bring together people who were physically there with people who are not there. So you could have people with cutout pass through where you're still kind of looking at each other and you don't feel as restrained by the VR headset. But then you could also have people who are remote and they could be joining the session via avatar and still feel engaged with the whole production design process. So that was really fun because we'd been building these tools internally for about 6 months. And then this was the first chance we had to kind of hand them over to these brilliant professionals and see what they could do with them.
That sounds incredibly exciting. I'd love to get a demonstration in person of that, or maybe virtually.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, a lot of the fun we were having going around London, stopping by, Squint Opera and Liquid City and Target 3D and whatnot, was to show them some of these tools and be like, look at this cool thing for the RSC, but also this could be for any space, because the RSC is being very generous with how else we use these tools we constructed. So that's really great. So let's talk a little more about your work on stage. So I noticed for Stranger Things, you guys were credited for video and visual effects design. And that's an interesting credit because it actually got me wondering, how long has that been, you know, how long has that been a credit for a stage show? Like, when did you guys first get involved with something on a major stage where you're like, well, probably the best credit for us is video and visual effects design?
So the first time we used the term video and visual effects design was for this show. So there's been, you know, video design is the new player in a very old industry, and for a long time people have wondered how to describe it. It's projection design, it's visual design, it's video design, and it hasn't ever really settled. And the problem is, as soon as it settles, what we do changes. And so suddenly no longer becomes relevant. You know, one of the hero surfaces in this show is a massive LED display. So clearly projection design is a misnomer for that. But particularly the reason with this one, why we have the credit visual effects design, visual effects as well as video, is that this is a show that's like laden with special effects. And those special effects are very rarely the product of one department. And it's a world where there are departments. It's kind of historically, you've had your set design, you've had your sound department, and so on. And video design would be sort of separate to that in some way. In this show, that just doesn't work. We all have to be working on everything together all the time. So one of the collaborators that was working us on this show, two of the collaborators who are working with us on this show, were the illusions designers. And that's not a role that, you know, is on every show at all. But they essentially working with us and working with particularly lighting and, of course, sound design as well. We were all sort of working together to create a moment of magic on the stage. And it's very hard to draw a line between one department and another in that case. So what we sort of did is went, okay, well, the visual elements of that is down to lighting and video and, you know, stage magic and so on. So we're actually sharing a visual effects credit with the illusions designers. But there is also our kind of traditional video design credit there as well. So it's a bit of a Frankenstein credit. But I think it's as close as we can get to representing the kind of breadth of what we do.
Amazing, Tom. So before we dive too deep into Stranger Things, The First Shadow, I'd love to know a little more about how this particular production came together. At what point were you asked to come on board? Was there similar work you guys had done in the past that made you guys seem like an obvious candidate for this? Or was there, you know, an intense bidding war and you guys won out with a complicated RFP process?
So we first heard about this project probably about 3 years ago, and it was very early days. Essentially, the genesis of the project was that Stephen Daldry wanted to make a theatre show based on Stranger Things. Loved the show, thought this is a great material to make a theatre show, and approached Netflix and the Duffer Brothers and said, you know, how about it? And they were like, oh my God, Stephen Daldry wants to make a show about our thing. This is really exciting. And that was a long time ago. It took a long time for that to become reality. But when it started to form more solidly, it was the producers, Sonia Friedman, who took it on. And they we've had a long working relationship with them on previous shows. We'd worked with Stephen before on things. We essentially were invited to come in and sort of throw some early ideas around. And we thought the best thing to do in that situation was to actually have a kind of physical kind of play space for a while. So we actually set up a kind of demonstration, some stage magic video driven effects in a soundstage. This must be back in 2019, I think it was. No, a bit more recently than that. But anyway, it was. This was like us just really being kind of super experimental. Like, what happens if we made the entire stage a Pepper's Ghost? What happens if we had kind of a massive, all sorts of crazy ideas, but trying to get at how can we make something on stage that's never been seen before. The project then, you know, hit the same problem that all live performance did with COVID, and it was shelved for a while, and then came back in 2023 at the beginning of 2023 with we're going to open this year, let's go. And it was suddenly this incredible sort of coming together of all these teams to try and work out how to put this wild thing together, and it began with a series of script workshops, which we got involved in a little bit, and then there was practical workshops in 3Mill Studios in London, where lots of illusion tests were undertaken, lots of kind of stage magic technology was tested, and we sort of gradually came up with a plan between all the different departments of how we might tackle all these moments that the amazing Kate Treefry, scriptwriter, had written into this script. And this was a bigger challenge than most theatre productions because, you know, Kate, this is the first stage production that Kate had written for. And she, well, I don't know, you know, I don't know what I should and shouldn't do in terms of suggesting these magical things that I would, you know, normally give to a director in a VFX house, and they would work out to do it on screen. But yeah, you're in the theater, and the direction to Kate's like, no, just write what you want to write. We'll find a way of making it work. So it was a super ambitious project right from the off. And that's kind of, as I was saying earlier about wanting to do things that we've never done before. This is like, yeah, that sounds right up our street. This is exactly what we love doing. So, you know, we threw ourselves into it. Built various model boxes and virtual models of the space. We tried all sorts of different things, and a huge number of those different things didn't work. And, you know, they were sort of, they get so far and then you go, ah, this is great, but it's never going to work in this environment. Or it's just makes the, you know, the, it's this for some practical reason or for some script reason, that idea gets shelved. So it was an incredibly intense and incredibly kind of energetic process getting this to the stage.
I'm curious, Tom, could you share an example of something that seemed like a really exciting idea, but for one reason or another, it didn't make it to the stage?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's a well-known stage illusion, Pepper's Ghost. So this is the, you know, the half silvered mirror or the Musion screen that, you know, you reflect some content that's happening somewhere else, either video content or actual, you know, real physical live content. And, you know, it sort of hangs in the space as if by magic. And this is what, you know, most commonly people talk about as being, you know, holograms. These are holograms. They're not holograms, of course, but like it's the closest we do on stage to a holographic illusion. We thought it would be an incredibly exciting thing to have the full stage Musion screen to allow us to do some really extraordinary kind of magical illusions. But we didn't want to do it all with video design. We were kind of interested in combining video design with physical illusion at this point. So we had grand plans for all sorts of things. You know, maybe we could have action taking place above the stage that's reflected on the Musion screen, and you know, wild ideas. But then of course, if you put a massive screen across the middle of the stage, you're making all sorts of restrictions for everyone else. You know, you start to build your show around the illusion. And ultimately, this is not a show about the illusions. It's a show about a boy and, you know, his story and the, you know, the story of the origin story that the show is. It's the number one thing in this show. So despite the fact we could have had some, like, a different set of wildly exciting illusions in the show, it was like, if that's going to cause everything else to have to move out of the way to give us space to do that, it was never going to be a goer. So, you know, there's quite a few moments like that. I think that we, we built an idea for a specific moment, and then you just have to balance that against the flow of the show and the storytelling and all the practical considerations as well around lighting and sound.
Was there anything that was ideated on very early on in the design process and actually did manage to stay a part of it the entire time and, you know, made it all the way to stage?
There is a lot of it. There's a huge number of sort of, it's not just illusions, but just sort of, can't think of a word to put it, but these kind of combined moments where all the departments work together to do something unexpected on stage. And some of those were there right from the very early days. And one of the things that we knew that we wanted to do in the show from a pretty early stage was recreate the blank void moment from the TV series. It's such an iconic image. And that was one of those things that, as an idea, was there from super early on. It was written into the script super early on. And we talked about all sorts of different ways of achieving it. And, you know, from like very practical effects to entirely digital effects. And so the way that we deliver that in the end was developed over time. But the idea that we needed to see that moment was there right from the beginning. So sometimes you just have to approach these things from multiple different angles until you find a way through to the result.
Absolutely. Well, let me take a brief moment to just heap some praise on the show, because I've seen plenty of live shows that are trying to tie into another universe. And the thing that struck me so much about this was I was expecting something that was kind of like, oh, here's a Stranger Things show, and it's almost like a different interpretation of a fictional source material. But this fits so nicely into the Netflix world. It feels like a theater show. It feels like it's meant for the stage, but it is absolutely in the same universe as the Netflix show. And even something as simple as getting like the red neon, you know, bars as they kind of fills up the proscenium of the stage edge there was like such a cool sort of thing that translates so well from film, television over to the stage. So I just want to start by saying, like, congratulations to you and everyone who was a part of this process of finding this perfect balance between doing something that does deserve to be on stage and would not be the same if it was just a TV episode, but still very much ties into that universe. And you really feel like these are the younger versions of a lot of the characters we see in the show. A lot of the design, the production design, the way everything feels, the tone fits so nicely into there. And I guess I'm curious, did you know from the beginning, like, this is cracking, this is totally going to work? Or was it a little touch and go? Did you feel at times like, I don't know, people might hate this? Like, how did it feel while you were in the middle of it?
Just to wind back a bit.
Yeah, sure.
So the challenge you described about how do you make this work? How do you take something from one world and put it into another? Was in the forefront of everyone's minds all the way through. And it's really, you know, like, kudos to Kate and Stephen and Justin, the co-director, to like, and the faith shown by Sonia Friedman to like pursue it even when you're thinking this is going to be this is going to be really tough to pull off. It was that sort of belief that drove everyone else through. And you know, in every department, we had those moments of going, "Oh my God, this is never going to happen." Or this is a disaster, or this, you know, this thing that we've been working on for months, you see it on stage and instantly, you know, it's, you know, has to be completely changed. There were lots of moments like that. There is a very kind of warts and all documentary on Netflix about the making of this show.
Cool.
Which digs into that in some detail, like the peril of putting this show together. Even though it's very warts and all, there's an awful lot of that which is on the cutting room floor, because you know that we went to some dark places in the process of making this show. And it was, you know, it was trying to do something that's never been done in on stage, and that is a risky business. And I think even after we were into previews in London, we still didn't know whether we had the right show. You know, look, often previews are about refining, you know, and this was much more than that. This preview period was like, we're testing this in front of the live audience to find out what it feels like to sit in front of it. Because, you know, you live with this thing for so long, it's very difficult to have perspective. You bring an audience in and you watch their reactions and you listen to their reactions and you talk to them afterwards and you go, okay, yeah, we need to pivot here because, you know, one reason or another, maybe something doesn't work technically, maybe one bit of storytelling isn't coming through. And there were so many moving parts that it really relied on that kind of that focus of having an audience in the space to be able to kind of to get a perspective that was useful. So yeah, it was an intense period for sure.
Yeah, amazing. Briefly, do you know, or could you speak to how Unreal Engine might have been used as part of the previs process? It also seems like maybe some of the flyover effects when you're seeing Hawkins and things like that, that might be rendered in Unreal Engine. Curious if you can tell us about any of that.
Well spotted, yes. So we used Unreal a little bit for previs in this show, but because a lot of the tools that we were working with for this existed, like, you know, we use a product called Disguise to do the video design on stage, and that has its own kind of previs. Unreal wasn't a super central part of the previs for this one, but I would like it to be for the next one, to be honest, because one of the things that we realized with any of the previs that we did where we were focusing on video is that without the lighting, without the scenery, without the texturing, and without all the other physical effects, you couldn't learn that much. You know, it's like, okay, yes, I made some video, I'm seeing it on a stage, it looks the right size, but where are the people? Where's the lighting? Where's the smoke? How is this going to look with all these things? And that's where you hit the limits on the kind of the previous capabilities of something like Disguise. unreal, I know, from other work that we've done, that we could make a more complete pre-visualization environment.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, so there's definitely an area to explore further. In terms of the generating content for the show, there's actually quite a lot of Unreal in this. The ones that, you know, you correctly identified, that the big flyovers over the town of Hawkins were made in Unreal. And there's also scatterings of Unreal throughout a lot of the rest of the show as well. And it's really one of those, this world is, theater design, video design for the theater is a very kind of, malleable one. We don't have a set process that, you know, this is, here's a shot, here's a script, this is what we do. We use this software, it goes here, gets graded, it conformed and all that sort of, well, that might be more familiar for visual effects. It's often, okay, here's the challenge. What's the right tool for it? And for example, the flyovers, we were very uncertain whether we could make that work. It's such a kind of, the flyovers is such a sort of lens-based technique that I was quite skeptical of whether this will come across as, well, just watching a big telly in the space, does that feel good or does that feel weird? And essentially, this led us to the conclusion that whatever we did, we needed to be able to pivot super quickly on this. So whether it was the speed of motion, you know, we don't want to make everyone sick sitting in the theater before we've even got to the first scene, or whether it's people suddenly, you know, the script suddenly pivoting, go, oh, actually, you know what, the time of day has changed, we need to redo this. And if we built this in one of our other more sort of visual effects oriented pipelines, we would have been sitting out in the theater going, I'm sorry, we can't do that for you. And we knew that's just not an answer that anyone wants to give. So we built that all in Unreal for the speed of iteration and to prioritize things that ultimately were more important than others. So the ability to change the camera move a day before the show opened, or the ability to drop in a reference to another scene that had only been entered the day before. You know, maybe we put a sign on the shop over here that does this or tells this bit of story. We wanted to keep that all flexible. So we used Unreal in that case. We were working with a team of animators and designers who had particular skill sets. And when you go, this guy and that piece of software and this scene, that when those three things come together, that's going to work really well. So it was so many sort of different elements going into the decision about what tool you use for what part of the job. But certainly, you know, speed was the, I think that was my answer to your word association right at the beginning of this. Was like, speed, yeah.
Go ahead.
No, so that's really like the genesis of using Unreal for that part of the show. Actually, you know, I'm probably a little bit behind the curve on what Unreal is capable of. And we bring it in and do a shot like that. And I was like, oh, okay, this is actually much, much more effective than I thought it was. You know, the last time maybe we did a similar shot in a previous show was a few years earlier. And, you know, things were that much cruder. And the developments have been pretty exciting. You know, that some of the challenges are still there, but it's definitely sort of maturing as a piece of software for us to use in the way that we like to use things.
That's amazing. So at risk of peeking a little bit behind the curtain, I'll try to ask this in a way where it hopefully won't spoil anything for anyone as well. There are moments in the show that they feel responsive, interactive. I'm curious if pretty much everything we're seeing in the show is pre-rendered, especially anything coming from Unreal, or if there actually are moments where something one of the actors is doing is actually going to create a real-time, you know, Unreal or disguise or whatever response based on what they're doing.
So it is all pre-rendered in that show. Although having said that, there are integrations with other departments that are happening in real time. So we're not running an Unreal Engine playback time in the theater. Yeah. It is all rendered. But there are instances where, for example, we have multiple, the piece of content is split up into multiple layers, and each layer is triggered at different points manually by someone responding to where an actor is on stage, for example. Mm-hmm. So it won't be exactly the same every night, even if everything goes perfectly. There are always these little variations. And some of the things that we've done with Unreal that we could do in real time, but have chosen not to, for example, integrating with the lighting desk. So there's moments where we have virtual scenery and we want it to feel like it belongs in the same world as the physical scenery. So when the lighting desk turns on this spotlight over here, we want the shadows to fall in the right way across the bit of scenery that's just projected. So in those cases, we've actually done that by like rendering out multiple passes and turning things on and off, listening to data coming from the lighting desk. But in theory, you could do that in real time, of course, with Unreal. And there are theater projects we're working on at the moment where we're considering that as a real time thing. But I mean, interestingly, like despite this being an incredibly adventurous and sort of boundary pushing production, our involvement kind of ends at the night that it opens to the public. So you want to leave something that is absolutely rock solid and is reproducible every night. So you have to be absolutely certain that anything you put in that is generative or real time is going to be utterly reliable. And then as a result of that, you go, well, is there any other way we could do this other than having something generating these pixels in the moment? Because, things do go wrong. So, we are probably a little cautious about bringing that kind of light technology into these long-running shows. That being said, we do a lot of performance work where we do have live generative content, but often those are for runs that are much shorter, where we may be present, for the whole duration of those runs, so that we can tweak things from night to night and we keep an eye on every performance. But it's currently probably not quite there with whether it's us and our faith in it or whether it's the technology itself, but to leave this stuff unattended and just doing something different every night, it's a big ask. And if we feel like we don't have to, we would probably avoid it.
Yeah, there's always a consideration for the potential points of failure. And we had a similar discussion, a colleague of mine and I, who went to the ABBA show, ABBA Voyage. And there was also the similar interesting discussion of like, well, what there is live or responsive in some way and what there is pre-recorded. And we came to the conclusion, like almost all of it was pre-recorded, including the video footage you see of the live band members. Like there's actual real band members who are right there on stage performing. They are live, but when you see them on the big screens, that is all pre-recorded footage. And so there's something really fascinating about, giving the audience an impression of liveness. And I was on a panel a couple of years ago at South by Southwest about this as well. Like if an audience thinks something was live, but then it wasn't live, like do they feel cheated, or is it like that's part of the illusion and the magic trick and it's exciting to realize that you'd been fooled? Very briefly, we do this annual production of Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol as a fully VR live show. Now it's entirely live. The first year we did it, we only had one actor playing as many characters as he could. And so with like the ghosts in the experience, they were all pre-recorded. And we also found that it was very tricky for our actor to get all the timing right to talk to the ghosts. So ultimately we're like, you know what? Anytime we're just talking to the ghosts, we're just going to have that be totally pre-recorded. And so a lot of the audience who saw the show in VR, they thought the entire thing was live and they didn't realize that what we were doing was like Dickens is talking to you. He's making eye contact with the audience. And then he's, smoothly sliding into like a cutscene basically where it's Scrooge and the ghosts talking to each other. And the response afterwards was really fascinating because so many people thought that they were there with a live actor the whole time, when in fact there were often these like 5 to 10 minute chunks where our actor could like take off his helmet and everything and go get a drink of water and dry off and then get back in. So very long-winded way of saying, like, I'm utterly fascinated by the tools we have at our disposal now to give an impression of liveness, even if that's not what's actually happening. Like, I'll give one example from Stranger Things without spoiling anything. There's these smoke effects. Some of the things going on in smoke, it felt absolutely in my production, like the actor playing Henry, Vecna, spoiler alert, I guess, is doing all this amazing stuff with the smoke, and it feels so responsive to his body movements. But I guess it's all just entirely pre-recorded, and he's just got that choreography down so well that it feels like it's coming from him.
Yeah, it's something that I got a lot of experience with quite a while ago working with dance companies. So my first experience with dance company actually came from something interactive that I'd made. Me and my colleague were working on these public art installations that use thermal imaging cameras to respond to the location of people in the space. And
so cool.
Some people's reaction is to come in and dance. And yeah. And then so we thought, like, this is great, but like, I wonder what an actual dancer would do with this. And we approached a dance company and said, can we do some workshops with you? And we took in, you know, this is like, I don't know, 2002, 2003. The technology was not kind of where it is today, but we set up some real-time environments and let the dancers play with it. And it was really exciting. And then we came to make a show. I said, oh, this is great. Let's build a show around this technique of projection interacting with dancers. And it became really apparent in that, and this is, you know, there are lots of reasons for it because of the crudeness of the technology or whatever, but it became really apparent that actually the dancers were more relaxed when they knew what they were going to work with. And that, you know, the responsive thing is great if it's an improvised thing that you're just coming in and you're doing once. But the dancers were like, the way they work is they work something out. They work with a choreographer to work out what they're trying to do, the story they're trying to tell. And then they want to work on that and improve on it and tell that story. And they want to be able, like, things to be able to, they want to work with other dancers and other bits of technology and other bits of scenery in a way that they can recreate and get comfortable with. And our stuff, which would just, it would follow them whatever they did, they found quite hard to respond to because it felt so passive. It wasn't pushing back at them. And weirdly, when we took a moment from the projections that we recorded with an interactive system and then played that back non-interactively, they found new things to do with it. They found that as a kind of almost like that's now a spur for them to like find a new interaction. And I think that is... So it was a good lesson in what we actually trying to do. You know, what's the end game of this? What are we trying to achieve? Are we trying to prove to people that we can do something very clever on stage? Mm-hmm. Or are we trying to have a dance performance that feels like it's like putting the story at the front and allowing the dancers to do their best work? And I sort of took that... That sort of stuck with me, that process, that experience of kind of taking a step back from what's possible and kind of going, well, you know, what's the desired outcome? And I sort of, that's always in the back of my mind now when we're working with technology. Because I'm as much as I'm a skeptic when it comes to some technology, I'm also a geek. And, you know, I love playing with something that offers some new real-time possibility. And, you know, quite honestly, I love the idea of having zero render times on things as well. So, like, that's the idea that you can just do it live is like really, really exciting. But you know, it's definitely one of those kind of areas of live technology where I think you just have to pick it, whether the thing you're doing is appropriate for that use.
Yeah.
And in Stranger Things, I think it was like something we used a lot for the rehearsal process and for the workshopping. We would be doing stuff absolutely live in the room and it was never the same twice. Then we found the thing that we really wanted to kind of hone and refine to put it on stage in front of people. That's when we moved into a more traditional video-based workflow.
Yeah. Yeah, you hear all the time about in film setups where there might be a director who's very okay with improv, but actually a lot of times it's not the improv takes that are making it directly into the film. They'll improv something and be like, yes, let's use that. And then they'll do four or five takes with that. But it's great when you have that kind of workflow where you can try stuff out to find the thing that you then want to nail down and do 1,000 times perfectly, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So like on stage with this, we'd often be using like a live streaming technology from something like After Effects, using NDI to get video content out on stage. So we could literally move things around on stage whilst the actors were there and go, how about over here? How about over there? Let's try this, try that. But, you know, a super low res crude version of the thing, really just like a blocking exercise of going,
yeah,
let's work out what this looks like in a blurry version. And then we're going to kind of, Once we know that it feels right in terms of movement and so on, that's when we can start kind of taking that and making the polished final product.
Absolutely. That's so cool. I wonder as well, Tom, if you had to imagine that the I ask this for anyone I know who's been involved with something that was interrupted by the pandemic, if this show had kind of stayed on its original track, what do you think would have been different about it if it came out earlier and we had no pandemic?
I might have had a few less gray hairs. I mean, essentially it's very hard to know what would have been different. I guess in that time, some of the technology had moved on, and some of the kind of, I guess the delivery systems like had moved on. I say that sounds very dull, but one of the things that we used in this show, which is certainly a new thing for us in a live theater environment, and I think it's kind of generally pretty unusual in theater, is we used like a 10-bit HDR workflow for all the LED content. Now that's something that you know, the systems that we were delivering the content with weren't capable of doing a few years earlier, and now we use that as a like throughout the show. And I don't know, I can't say whether the audience notices it. I feel that it makes an absolutely huge difference to the kind of the depth on stage that you can get, to really kind of get those blacks and those popping highlights and things that make that back wall of LED disappear and become a kind of three-dimensional trompe l'oeil space. So I certainly think from a technical point of view, it would, it benefited from the delay. On the flip side, what would have been a intense development period became an even shorter intense development period to get this out. So, it was definitely, I suppose, one of those things that we were just so eager to get out into the world that once there was an opportunity to do it, everyone just like ran with it as hard as they could.
Yeah, I hear you. You guys ever talk about cognitive load when working with new technologies? Does that term come up at all?
Not for me.
I think it's kind of an interesting one, especially when you're considering both the audience experience, but also what it's like for the performers. Like if they're using a lot of new technologies, tools that they're not familiar with, unless it's something super intuitive, like, you know, the iPhone with a touchscreen, we've definitely found that we've hit some limitations with how much, you know, brain someone could be using when working with something really difficult. And one thing I found myself experiencing as an audience member too, during the Stranger Things First Shadow show, was that there were so many traditional theatrical conventions being used that date back as far back as we've had theater, and even things that we see more and more of lately, like, you know, a nice rotating stage that can get used in all sorts of different ways. And the way technology is being used, especially the video effects and some of the crazier spectacular things, that they were always done in such a way where I could appreciate them a little bit as a magic trick, a little bit as part of the show, as part of the spectacle, as part of something that moves the story forward. But it was never the kind of thing that my brain would get tied up in and really have a lot of trouble reconciling. Like maybe the closest I had to that would have been some of the early moments where, minor spoiler, there's multiple versions of someone like Henry. And you're trying to figure out, like, is that a video version or is there another actor playing Henry? And eventually you kind of like resolve this stuff. But like that would be an example to me of cognitive load, where your brain gets hung up a little bit on like, wait, what exactly is going on? And then you're able to hopefully move on, and then it's not something that's weighing you down anymore. But yeah, I'm curious, I guess, if you guys ever talk about, like, this is a really cool effect or moment or something for not just Stranger Things, but any of your work, but you maybe back off from it a little bit because of the effect it might have on the performers or the audience.
100%. I mean, it's the term I've not used, but it makes complete sense. But that's a conversation we have a lot. I think there is a, I mean, we have a kind of, I suppose, a strap line or a motto as a company, which is like story-driven design.
And yeah.
That really is just reflective of the way that I think we all think about the design process, that it has to serve the storytelling. It has to, like, be a it's not a veneer or a layer or like a fireworks show that kind of makes something just more spectacular. It has to in some way push the serve the narrative, I guess. And one of the things that it's very easy to do is snap people out by doing something that is, like, however clever it is, just feels like, I suppose the word is gratuitous. Like,
yeah, sure. extra, as the kids would say.
Extra. As the, yeah, exactly. That's how my kids would put it. And, you know, there's on this show, I think we allowed ourselves some moments to go, yeah, okay, we'll do that now. Because Stranger Things as a TV series, I think, does a similar thing at points. It's like, it, I think what's so brilliant about it as a series is the way in which it moves you from something that is maybe quite, I suppose, a personal, intimate story about coming of age, and then gives you like a section that's just a homage to a piece of classic horror or cinema. And that you can kind of, it's almost like you get rewarded for your attention by these moments where it's like, and now I'm just going to do something that's going to be really exciting or spectacular or scary. And it, yeah, maybe that doesn't in itself push the story forward that moment, but as an, we're thinking of you as an audience in a kind of an intelligent way, saying, okay, thanks for your attention. I know you're going to mull on that for a while. Now we're just going to do something to, like, excite you. And then we can come back and we can deal with something that's maybe a little bit more, more serious or more character driven another point. And that same sort of thinking, I think, went into the stage show. So the sort of cognitive load thing, like, are we doing too much? Is this going to distract people and bring them back into their bodies for a bit to go, oh, I'm in a theater and I'm just thinking about where that thing came from or how that disappeared. I think we allow ourselves to do that sometimes, but it was always tried to keep it away from those moments where maybe the two lead characters are going through something that is, yeah, that's the most important thing at this point, you know. And we had some really interesting conversations, and this is where, like, Stephen and Justin were so good at bringing us back to that focus and saying, you know, we would see something really, like, I don't know, maybe in a rehearsal, something went technically wrong. And we're all thinking, oh, God, you know, we're going to have to spend ages working on how to resolve that technical thing. And in the note session afterwards, Stephen would be like, the real problem with that section is the story. I don't believe what that person's saying. And, like, yeah, good point. And, like, maybe you didn't believe it because we were getting in the way of it with something big that was happening on stage, or maybe there was, you know, it was too close to something that was, you know, maybe we were shaping the whole stage so that we could deliver the next illusion rather than prioritizing the blocking that tells the story. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's a team effort, and, you know, we definitely try and think about it at 59, and it's also one of those things where you have to kind of listen to the other voices in the room and kind of take some perspective. And again, coming back to the audience, ultimately, it's the audience who kind of give you that feedback. It's lovely to get a round of applause for a special effect, but, like, that goes fairly quickly. You know, that kind of buzz dissipates quickly. Whereas if you can make somebody feel something about a character, that might stay with them for days. So, like, I think there's it's always a delicate balance, sure. Yeah.
That's really well put, Tom. I particularly love the moments in the show where you, in retrospect, of course, yeah, realize this was 10 different departments who all had to do their best work to have this all come together. But in the moment, you're not thinking about any of that. It's all just coming together as this beautiful kind of emotional, powerful moment. Again, we're doing a pretty good job avoiding spoilers, but there's a moment where everything goes into slow motion in the show, which is just like breathtaking and spectacular. And like what I had to like replay it back in my mind to like try to figure out all the different things working in symphony to make that happen. But just what a cool show. Like, I can't recommend enough that people check it out. I was lucky enough to get Rush tickets. It's in New York. It's in London. Yeah. Anything else you wanted to say about the show, Tom?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's, I'd encourage people to go to it who don't normally go to the theater. I think it's not a show that is made to, squarely for a Broadway or West End audience. It's made for people who like Stranger Things, I'd say. You can go and see it if you've never seen Stranger Things. You'll see a spectacular show. I think if you are a fan of the show, it's worth, maybe you haven't stepped in a theater for a while. I'd say it's absolutely worth going in and having a look, seeing what you make of it.
Yeah, I agree completely. And for anyone who's into this sort of thing, the actor who is playing Bob Newby, Sean Astin's character, has the most uncanny vocal resemblance to Sean Astin in the show. And I was so tickled by it the entire time. All the actors who are doing a younger version of other characters we know are so perfect. But especially because it's all British actors doing American accents. That one in particular was quite delightful. Can't recommend the show enough. Tom, this has been such a fun discussion. A couple things to wrap up. Actually, first of all, before we even wrap up, I did want to mention that I remember the first time I heard about Journey as a company, before I think there were too many acquisitions going on with it, was a company that we've actually collaborated with a little bit in New York City called iCrave. And I think they're primarily based in New York City, but I'm curious if you've had any direct interaction with them.
Yeah, so iCrave, the pretty much the founding studio of Journey, and based in New York, and we now have shared offices with them in New York, which is really exciting for us. They bring a whole load of expertise in sort of public facing design, interior design, and fit out, and so on, which is very exciting for us because we're often not only asked to design the show, but also to design the venue in which the show goes. So to have within the family of Journey, a team like iCrave on board just kind of suddenly makes that feel much more possible. It's super exciting to have them on board, and also the skills set that they bring. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. They've been a huge inspiration to us the entire time we've been working in VR and with emerging technology and all of that. Tom, where can people find you if they want to reach out and say hi?
To me, well, 59, we're based in London. You're very welcome to drop. Anyone's welcome to drop into the studios in North London. But if you want to get in touch with me, my email is tom.wexler@59.studio. Very happy to have anything that's come out of this that you want to follow up on. I'm very happy to chat to you. I'm on LinkedIn. You'll find me. There aren't many Tom Wexlers. Please get in touch. It'd be fascinating to know what comes from it.
Yeah. Are there any other shows or events coming up that you or your team are involved with that people should keep an eye out for?
Sure. Yeah. We've got we've just opened, we just opened the Prehistoric Planet show at Library in London, which is, that's only a week open now. So you should get yourself along to it. It's a lot of fun, especially if you have children. We all are children to some extent when we're presented with a 40-foot high dinosaur, but it's a lot of fun. We've got a few more theater shows coming up that are going to be out in the world in the next year. We're working on a musical with Sting, which is should see the light of day later this year. I think that's going to be super exciting. We're also working on opera that's opening the Met Opera's season this year. So quite a lot of stage work coming up, and more in the pipeline that I can't tell you about. But yeah, I'm really excited about the kind of opportunities that have come up, partly through working on a show like Stranger Things and kind of finding a new audience.
Yeah, absolutely. And then finally, Tom, we get asked a lot about, there's a lot of younger listeners who are kind of getting in this world and trying to break in. And we get asked a lot, you know, what's some advice that seasoned veterans like yourself might have for someone who's trying to find their way into this amazing new world of utilizing emerging technology with all sorts of, you know, more traditional mediums like stage shows, but also film. Any thoughts on that?
I mean, my advice would be go and see as much stuff as you possibly can. And this is not me trying to plug the shows that we put out there, but like get into live environments, go and see what's happening out there. There's amazing stuff happening. You're not just the kind of West End, Broadway headline stuff, but like people are doing really amazing work in small venues, in colleges, in schools around, you know, US and the UK and Europe and all over the world. And if you put yourself in those environments, see what inspires you. And maybe it's the kind of the combination of that and the curiosity to just keep kind of trying things you've not done before. A lot of what we do, as I was referring to earlier, is like trying combinations of technology and performance and environments that not been put together before. So, you know, if you're into your Unreal and you tended to make stuff for screen, what about doing something for projection? What about like setting up something in a live space? What about doing something at a different scale? I just be experimental, be playful, would be my kind of headline.
Yeah, very sage wisdom. Appreciate that, Tom. One more thing I forgot to mention in way of announcements. Since the last time we had an episode, I have somehow become the leader organizer of meetup.com/Unreal Engine, which is the link for the New York City Unreal Engine meetup group. We had our first meetup at Epic Games' headquarters in New York recently. We have our next meetup next week on Thursday. That's July 24th. It'll be at 6 p.m. over at Jet Set Studios. They're a virtual production studio, and we'll have some really cool talks from them, as well as Anthony, whose last name I can never pronounce, who does super cool stuff with MetaHumans. So if you're in the New York City area, be sure to drop on by for that. Thank you, Tom. This was such a pleasure. We try to end the show with a very awkward virtual high five, which we often use for the thumbnail. If you'll
indulge. Which way are you that way?
It's amazing how quickly we're like, we don't even know quite where we are. There we go. Like, that's pretty good. And then just something that will work well for a thumbnail. Like, hey, cool. All right. Thank you, Tom. Till next time, everyone. Appreciate all of your listens and thoughts, and feel free to email us at I've already forgot our email handle, unoffuepod@gmail.com, and of course on all the social media handles. And we'll see you next time. Thanks and goodbye.